Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being with us on this Holy Week. I hope you're having a good Holy Week. Holy Thursday tomorrow, Good Friday after that. And then you could probably figure out when Easter fits in that whole thing. Our guest this hour is Carlo Broussard, apologist extraordinaire here at Catholic Answers. I mentioned his books last hour, but I'm holding in my hand What Lies Beyond, Understanding Purgatory, Heaven, and Hell. A beautiful CD set from Carlo. And then I got over here, Your Truth, My Truth, How to Understand and Refute Relativistic Thinking.
And then also, too, I actually have a CD set, two CD sets on the very topics we're talking about today.
Why do I not have them?
I don't know why you don't have them. That's a good question for you to ask yourself.
I didn't know where Guam was. And I didn't know about this.
So I have a CD set called The Bible Blueprint for the Mass, where I go into great detail on the Eucharist, and then The Bible Blueprint for the Priesthood. So some of the things that we're talking about today are in both of those CD sets. And then I also have another CD set that you and I did together. That one?
I do know about that one. Yes, I do know.
Why doesn't God show his face? Yeah. Examining the problem of divine hiddenness. So our listeners can get a hold of that as well at shop.catholic.com.
Like that? Very good. That's bad, shop.catholic.com. Very nice. All right. We're back. If you've waited on the phone, thank you so much for waiting. We're talking about the Eucharist. We're talking about the priesthood. And we're talking about the Bible blueprint for these two realities. And you are especially invited if you disagree with us, of course. So Protestants are welcome to call, because this is a fundamental point of disagreement between Protestants and, how should I say this, everybody else in the Christian world. That's probably not the way I should have said that.
Not everybody else.
Well, Orthodox.
The Orthodox agree with us.
That's what I'm saying. This is a difference between Protestants and everybody else.
Okay. My apologies. I missed that. I'm sorry. Compute.
So but I was being a little bit of a smart aleck.
We're on the same page now of lack of computation.
my computation's low today. I don't know why. It's 40 days without chocolate. How can a person live like this? It's insane. All right. The number is 888-318-7884. Jerry's in Buffalo, New York. Please help me, Jerry, by having a good question. Watching on Facebook Live. Jerry, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Thank you. Well, I have Jewish roots to my family on my mom's side. And even though I was raised Christian, I have friends that are Messianic Jews.
Okay.
And for the listener, those are Jews that believe that Jesus is the Messiah. So they also say completed Jews. But right. We've bounced back and forth about our Eucharist, what we consider the Eucharist, and that. And, you know, they're saying is this is something that was done by the Jews for years. They said, well, we were the first church, you know, the Messianic Jews. And they said that was considered a Passover Seder. And I said, you know, but bread was broken. And I mean, lamb wasn't broken at the table, type of thing, but they're pretty hard to convince because of all that history. Otherwise the priest would be handing out lamb chops on Sunday morning. So it's a difficult thing for them to grasp,
okay,
because of those deep roots. So that was my question: is how explaining to someone with that background, whether it be Messianic or Judaic in general, how could you make a convincing argument for that?
That this is something more than just the Seder,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
Well, there are a few ways that we can go about doing it, Jerry, but before I articulate a couple of paths that we can take, I would recommend that you get a hold of the book entitled The Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist by Dr. Brant Petrie. It's a phenomenal book, and the whole purpose of the book is to examine the Last Supper through a Jewish lens and looking at the Last Supper in light of a variety of Old Testament events and passages, one of which, of course, is the Passover where the lamb was to be eaten. So it's very explicit and very at the forefront of the instructions that Moses gives the Israelites in the book of Exodus when he's giving them the instructions about celebrating the Passover meal, that not only are they to sacrifice the lamb and to spread the blood over the doorpost, but that they are to eat the flesh of the lamb. And surely what Jesus is doing at the Last Supper is he is instituting a new Passover. And I think both Protestants and Catholics can agree with that. Like, this is something new going on here, right? Because Jesus is breaking with the Passover ritual and actually saying new things like, this is my body, this is my blood. Given that fact in and of itself, tells us he's doing something different and something new. As to whether it is more than bread and actually his body and blood, well, you could appeal to the fact that, hey, if real flesh was to be eaten at the old Passover, well, then how much more would real flesh need to be eaten for the new Passover? And there are other pathways that we can take, Jerry. Consider this. And I like this line of reasoning that Dr. Brent Petrie uses in his book. Jesus reveals to us in the synagogue at Capernaum in John chapter 6, he draws a parallel between what he's going to be giving us at the Last Supper, namely the Eucharist, what he calls the bread of life, which he identifies to be his flesh, and the manna in the Old Testament, right? So recall, you know, your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. The bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh, and whoever eats of it will live forever. So Jesus draws an intentional parallel between the Eucharist and the manna of old. Now think about this, Jerry. That Old Testament manna, that bread from heaven, it was miraculous, right? It had miraculous aspects to it. It appeared every day, whenever with the coming of the dew, and whenever the dew would burn off, the manna would appear. It would only last for a day, and if any of the Jews would keep more than they were supposed to, it would corrupt and turn foul and breed worms, the Bible tells us in Exodus chapter 16, except on the Sabbath. They would collect enough for the Sabbath. It would not appear on the Sabbath, and whatever they had left over, it would not corrupt. It would not breed worms. And this happened for 40 years until they entered into the Promised Land. According to Joshua 5, the manna ceased. So that manna, that Old Testament bread from heaven, was miraculous bread. And Jesus explicitly teaches us that what he gives us in the Eucharist at the Last Supper is to be understood against the backdrop of the old manna. And so therefore, the Eucharist is the new manna. Now think about this, Jerry. If the old manna was supernatural, miraculous, well, how much more would the new manna, the Eucharist, need to be supernatural and miraculous? Much more. And if miraculous, then what Jesus is giving us at the Last Supper cannot be mere signs of his body and his blood. Jesus intentionally creates a miraculous environment surrounding what he's doing at the Last Supper. And given that supernatural, miraculous environment, we're able to easily conclude that when he says, this is bread, take this, all of you need it, this is my body, given the supernatural, miraculous context, it allows for us to easily conclude that he's doing something supernatural and miraculous. And what is that? What he says he's doing. He's making it his body and his blood. And so the Old Testament Passover, the Old Testament manna, these are all things that we can appeal to in the Old Testament as a backdrop against which we can understand what Jesus is doing. And finally, I'll just throw out one more to you, Jerry. Notice how Jesus says when he's referring to the contents of the chalice or the cup, he refers to it as the blood of the new and everlasting covenant in Luke's version, simply the blood of the covenant in Matthew's version. Well, that's a direct allusion to Exodus chapter 24, when Moses calls the blood that he's sprinkling upon the Israelites in order to ratify the Sinaitic covenant, he calls that blood the blood of the covenant. And so for Jesus to make a direct allusion to what Moses did in Exodus 24 clues us in on how we are to understand what Jesus is doing at the Last Supper. In other words, we're to understand what Jesus is doing at the Last Supper in light of what Moses did on Sinai in Exodus 24. Well, just as real blood was used to ratify the Sinaitic covenant, and what Jesus is doing at the Last Supper is to be read in light of that, therefore it's the ratifying ceremony of the new covenant, well, how much more would real, substantial blood need to be present at this new covenant ratifying ceremony? And what makes it superior to what Moses did in the Old Testament is that it's not animal blood that's ratifying the that's constituting the ratifying ceremony of the covenant. It's Jesus's blood, the true lamb. So these are three different Old Testament prefigurements or types that shed light upon what Jesus is doing at the Last Supper. And this is not made up. Jesus directly connects what he's doing at the Last Supper to these three events. So those are just a few things that we can say to begin with. And of course, Jerry, there's more, and Dr. Brent Petrie goes into those details in his book. What do you think of that, brother?
No, I think that's good, especially approaching it through a covenant way. They're a covenant. They should know that that's through with Exodus and everything. God made the covenant with them until they broke it. So that's a good approach. And I'll pick up that book. Brent Petrie,
Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist.
Thanks, Jerry. We got to take a quick break. Carlo Broussard is our guest. We're talking priesthood and the Eucharist this hour. If you've got a question, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connection's set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
This is what St. Teresa of Calcutta, also known as Mother Teresa, once said about prayer. Love to pray. Feel often during the day the need for prayer and take trouble to pray. Prayer enlarges the heart until it is capable of containing God's gift of Himself. Ask and seek, and your heart will grow big enough to receive Him and keep Him as your own. That is why we need prayer.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carlo Broussard, our guest, and we're talking about the Bible blueprint for the priesthood and the Eucharist this hour. 888-318-7884 is our number. We've got a new School of Apologetics mini course I want to tell you about. Maybe you're a passionately pro-life person, but you get nervous about sharing your views with pro-choice friends and family members. Maybe you worry that the conversation will become a heated argument, and so you avoid it. Well, we can help you with that with the new course that is called Arguing Against Abortion, available now at the School of Apologetics. As a matter of fact, they're going to give you $10 off because I'm talking about it right now, and they gave that deal to us here in the radio department. Just go to schoolofapologetics.com. Arguing Against Abortion, a new mini course in the School of Apologetics. We're talking about the priesthood and the Eucharist and the Bible blueprint for both of them, as I said. And we go now to Riyadh in Troy, Michigan, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Riyadh, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I actually had, while I was waiting, I was told also it was for the Eucharist, and I wanted to know about this particular answer as well regarding the Eucharist. It's actually two different questions. One of them is the Pontius Pilate, when he gave away Christ to be crucified. My argument sometimes with people that I believe he's still going to be judged. He shouldn't just simply wash in his hand. I don't think that he has a right to just get away from that responsibility, but they say no. He does. He didn't believe that he was innocent. He believed that he was innocent, so he shouldn't be at fault with God.
Well, let me ask Carlo and then we'll get to the second question. I mean, Pontius Pilate washed his hands famously of Jesus and the whole affair.
Right. Matthew 27:24, I am innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves. And so, Riyadh, you know, I would agree with you that just because he says, yeah, I'm innocent, you know, I'm not culpable for this man's death, that doesn't mean he's actually innocent, right? Now, granted, we can't judge Pontius Pilate and his soul. We don't, you know, only God has access to the inner movements of his heart and mind. But we can state, objectively speaking, that he should not have given Jesus over to be crucified because, as you rightfully pointed out, Riyadh, and we know from the Gospels, that he could not find any fault in Jesus, no grounds upon which he could decree capital punishment to be just. So what he did, objectively speaking, was indeed unjust, and it was wrong, and he should not have done that. as to whether he was culpable for that, and God judged him for that, and he went to hell for that. We don't know, and so we leave that up to God. But you are thinking correctly, Riyadh, that we shouldn't just say, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's off the hook. He's not responsible. I think that's too far on the other side.
And your second question, Riyadh?
Abortion. Yeah, I kind of relate to abortion, too. Like, they avoid not to tell the other person don't do it, you know? I think they're part of it, you know, not giving them advice that is wrong. But the second question also what disturbed me, because I have a half-brother who has passed away, and he, apparently his mother was Greek Orthodox. And at one time, like, he would, like, refuse to take Eucharist from the Catholic Church. And I would tell him I would not take the Orthodox Church Eucharist, only my Catholic Church. And I remember with I forgot the name of the priest. I have the book, an old book. It's called Catholicism for Dummies.
Oh, yeah, that's John. We know Father John Trujillo. Okay, so your question is about your half-brother not receiving the Eucharist. What did you want to ask Carlo?
Well, I'm thinking if Christ found the Catholic Church, and he gave authority commission to the Peter, the first pope, and, you know, he ordained them, you know, in John 20 when he breathed on them.
Okay.
How can we say that it's a valid Eucharist?
Ah, that the Orthodox
even,
have.
Even, yeah. Because even Benedict says there that the Orthodox Church, it is a defective religion, like has some false. And the Protestant churches are nothing but a prayer hall.
Okay,
well, they're not. Yeah,
okay, well, so, I think we have the question, Riyadh. Yeah. It essentially comes down to how can you claim, if you're not in union, I suppose, with the Pope, that you have valid Eucharist? Why do we say that about the Orthodox?
Right. Well, union with the Pope is not a condition for having valid bishops. The condition for having valid bishops is to have a man ordained by a bishop who is validly ordained and who has succession all the way back to one of the apostles. What separates Orthodox Christians from Catholics is the essential difference is union with the Bishop of Rome, looking to the Bishop of Rome as the supreme leader of Christ's flock here on earth. That is what separates us. That is the condition for being Catholic. It is possible to have an individual who has historical succession and continuity back to the apostles and thus has the valid powers in order to bring about Jesus in the Eucharist and to confect the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. Now, that validity of the Eucharist is distinct from such successors of the apostles having the permission to celebrate those sacraments, right? And so this is where union with the Bishop of Rome comes in. So because the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter and the supreme universal shepherd of Christ's flock on this earth and the guardian of all of the gifts that Christ has given us, including the sacraments, he has supreme jurisdiction over and governing the use of the sacraments. And so it's necessary to be united with the Bishop of Rome in order to exercise publicly the powers that one objectively has as being a successor to the apostle. So it's the exercising of the ministry that one needs to be in union with the Bishop of Rome in order to accomplish. But to actually have the powers themselves, the condition for that is to be ordained by a valid bishop who has historical continuity and succession back to the apostles.
Thanks very much, Riyadh. Appreciate the call. Carlo Broussard is our guest. I hope that was helpful to you, Riyadh. Carlo Broussard is our guest, and we're talking about the Bible blueprint for the priesthood and the Eucharist. And whenever we talk about the Bible blueprint, Carlo, I feel like a good part of that is that there are many Christians who only accept the authority of the Bible, don't accept
right.
the authority of tradition. And so we want to give the Bible blueprint in part to educate Catholics about that these things are rooted in Scripture, but also our Protestant brothers and sisters. So what are some of the objections you get to the let's say, the ministerial priesthood from Protestants who will say, wait a second, Carlo, what specific objection would be, but in general would say, well, Christ said we're all priests and there's a universal priesthood. Why are you focused on this ministerial priesthood?
Yeah, St. Peter said that in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 5 and 9, where he refers to all Christians as the universal priesthood, right? A kingdom of priests.
Yeah.
And actually quoting an Old Testament text, Exodus chapter 19, where Moses was speaking of Exodus chapter 19, where we find that same language being used in reference to the Israel of God. And so St. Peter applies that language to the Christian church, thus revealing that in as much as we are baptized, we all are united to Christ the high priest as members of his mystical body, and therefore we are all priests in that sense.
Yeah.
And so it follows from that there are some priestly functions that we can engage in as baptized Christians, like praying for other people, intercessory prayer. That's a priestly function. But according to God's revelation, that's a priestly function that we all share in baptized members of the mystical body of Christ. We can offer some sacrifices. So as St. Paul says in Romans 12:1, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice pleasing unto the Lord. We can offer our bodies and our sufferings and our trials and our tribulations and offer that up to God as a gift, as a sacrifice. And that's a priestly function in a limited way, but nevertheless a priestly function. And so it is true that we are all priests. But the question is, did Jesus constitute any of these members of his church, of his community, to be priests in a hierarchical way, like a higher rank of priests,
yeah,
or priestly, or and to perform priestly ministries that other members of the Christian body do not perform? And the answer from the Catholic perspective is yes. As I point out in my CD set, The Bible Blueprint for the Priesthood, I give evidence to back up that claim. Also have some articles at Catholic.com that I wrote for Catholic Answers magazine online of giving some biblical evidence for the priesthood. I already appealed to one element of the Bible blueprint for the priesthood at the Last Supper. Jesus tells the apostles, do this in remembrance of me. But there's also an interesting passage in Romans chapter 15 where St. Paul refers to his own ministry as a priestly ministry. And in the Greek text, the Greek word that's used there signifies priestly service. And so it seems as if Paul understands his own apostolic ministry as a priestly ministry.
Yeah.
And so that's a recognition of it. Now, getting back to Jesus instituting the apostles as priests, we could also appeal to John chapter 20, verse 23, where Jesus tells them, whatever sins you forgive, they are forgiven, and whatever sins you retain, they are retained. What's interesting about that, Si, is that in the Old Testament, God set up a system to reconcile his people back to himself that actually involved priestly ministry and his priests.
Right.
So, for example, Leviticus 5, Numbers 15, I'm thinking of, you find instructions that, hey, if you got a sin, you take your sacrificial victim to the priest, and he's to offer a sacrifice for the atonement of sin, and there's even confession of sin that goes on. And so notice how in the Old Testament, God associated his ordained priestly ministers with reconciling his people back to himself and having their sins forgiven. And so here we have Jesus telling the apostles to forgive sins, to retain sins. So given that Old Testament backdrop, it sheds light upon how we to understand what Jesus is doing here. He's now going to use the apostles as his ordained ministers in reconciling people back to God within the context of forgiving sins, thus indicating for us that he's constituting them as his new covenant ministerial priests, which goes over and above the priesthood of the baptized,
right,
of those members of the mystical body of Christ.
So we can see the groundwork laid, or the image is given to us in the Hebrew scriptures and through the whole the history of the Jewish people that comes to its fulfillment then,
yes,
in the Christian era.
Yeah, and getting back to, I'm glad you brought that up, because getting back to St. Peter in 1 Peter 2, 5 and 9, where he refers to the Christian church as a kingdom of priests, a priestly kingdom, verbatim quoting Exodus, a passage in Exodus chapter 19, referring to the old Israel of God. And so Peter's making a direct connection between the new Israel of God and the old Israel of God. And you have this common level priesthood, right? Well, there's also a connection between the new and the old in the high priestly rank. So in the old, it was Aaron and his sons. We read about that in Exodus chapter 28. They are the high priests. We know Jesus is the high priest, according to Hebrews 3:1. So if there's a higher rank of priestly ministry connection between the new and the old, lower rank, there's going to be a middle, which there were, the sons of Aaron. They served as ministerial priests.
Carla Broussard is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. Whether you are Catholic or not Catholic, you're welcome to call and ask your questions about the priesthood and the Eucharist. 888-31-TRUTH.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
According to divine command, we should give God worship. But how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help? To make me feel better? A form of social activism or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship, God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What part of Jesus' suffering do you think was most difficult? That's tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. A very blessed Holy Week to you and all of yours. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Carla Broussard is our guest. Carla is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, speaker extraordinaire. Just got back from Michigan giving a three-night mission on the Eucharist. So if you've got questions on the Eucharist, it's all fresh in his mind. But this hour, we're talking about the priesthood and the Eucharist in large part because tomorrow on Holy Thursday, there's a profound connection in our celebration of Holy Thursday and the establishment of the Eucharist and the priesthood, with the actions that Christ took on Holy Thursday, when we commemorate as Holy Thursday now. Are actions that, in fact, do establish the Eucharist and the priesthood. And he, in fact, takes actions to establish the Eucharist and the priesthood throughout his ministry. And so we see those as central to living the Christian life. Not all Christians agree with us. If you are one who does not agree and would like to have a conversation about that, you're welcome. 888-318-7884. If you are one who does agree and would like some insight into exactly what all of this means, or you have some challenges that have been made to you and you'd like some help addressing them, you're welcome to call as well. 888-318-7884. I am going to go back to calls and back to you, Carlo, but I was supposed to have done this throughout and I have not done it. Carlo has this, his latest book is called purgatory is for real. Good news about the afterlife for those who aren't perfect yet. And I didn't realize I had this in my hand that they have. It's on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. So I was supposed to say that throughout the hour. You can order your copy at shop.catholic.com, and they'll even give you an extra special deal if you order some for friends. If you get five copies of it, it's just $40. So if you want to give it out and share it with others, shop.catholic.com is where you can do that. I have heard the objection, and I'm going to give you my objection, and then I will go back to the phones. Look, Jesus says a lot of stuff about who he is and what he is. I'm the sheep gate. I'm a door. I'm the vine. You are the branches. I don't actually literally believe Jesus is a vine or a door. Why am I supposed to believe that he's being literal when he says that you should eat his flesh, that his flesh is real food and his drink, his blood is real drink, and you should eat his flesh and drink his blood? Why should I take that literally when he doesn't always speak literally?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it is true. Like, for example, in John 10:9, I am the door. John 15:5, I am the vine. You know, we don't think that we should go get some clippers and start clipping branches off of Jesus or something,
right,
or getting
exactly.
WD-40 and yeah. oiling his hinges. And I think the answer is precisely that applied to the audience. So when we look at the audience, when Jesus said these things, and contrast that with the audience in John chapter 6, when Jesus spoke of being the bread of life and identifying that bread as his flesh and giving the command to eat his flesh and to drink his blood. Whenever he said, I am the door and I am the vine, the audience did not say,
Wait a second.
Oh, by golly, let's go get the WD-40 and start, you know, oiling his hinges or you know, clipping vines off of him. They don't respond in a way that would suggest that they think he's speaking literally.
Right.
And of course, Jesus doesn't go beyond that and say, oh, hey, wait a minute, guys, I am speaking here literally and you're taking me metaphorically.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's nothing in the text itself that would suggest Jesus is speaking literally in these passages. So we have good reason to conclude he's not speaking literally, but speaking metaphorically. When we come to John 6, I'll agree that if all we had was Jesus just simply saying, hey, eat my flesh and drink my blood, and that's it, and then he goes on to something else, that argument would have some traction, right?
Sure.
He's saying, hey, he's speaking metaphorically over here. Then all things considered, nothing else considered, he's speaking metaphorically here. But we do have other details. We do have the reaction of his audience to his statements from both the Jews and the disciples. And we also have Jesus's response to those reactions and how he handles their difficulty. And rather, as I mentioned earlier, I think either in this broadcast or in the previous hour, rather than easing the difficulty, he intensifies the difficulty. He doubles down. He doesn't back up, right? So in response to the Jews' difficulty, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? He reaffirms 6 times in 6 verses to eat his flesh and drink his blood. And in fact, Cy, in the Greek text, John actually changes the Greek word for eat from a more generic eating to a more graphic form word for eating, to gnaw and to chew.
Yeah.
So John actually switches the Greek verb whenever Jesus begins to respond to the difficulty that the Jews are having. Why would John intensify the language if he thought Jesus was backing down and trying to ease the difficulty? And so Jesus's response to the Jews having a hard time with the teaching indicates to us that he was not intending these words to be taken metaphorically. He was speaking literally, and he was affirming the literal thoughts of the Jews. And then, of course, the disciples respond as well. This is a hard saying. Who can accept it? And Jesus, once again, rather than backing down and easing the difficulty, he says, you think that's hard? What if you're going to see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? That's difficult, man. That's some miraculous stuff, right?
Right.
Well, just as miraculous as that is, so too the miraculous aspect of eating his flesh and drinking his blood, which is actually in turn a help, because that indicates to us that, well, there's something going to be miraculous here in how Jesus is going to give us his flesh and his blood. And then that follows up with The spirit gives life, the flesh is of no avail. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life. In order to teach his disciples, the flesh is of no avail. That's a Hebrew idiom for making judgments from an earthly perspective. John chapter 8, verse 5, he's telling the Pharisees, you make judgments according to the flesh,
yeah,
right? You're only
right.
thinking from an earthly perspective. In other words, concerning this teaching to eat his flesh and drink his blood, you ain't going to buy it. You ain't going to accept it if you're making judgments from an earthly perspective. And so it's something, and the reason is because this is supernatural.
Yeah.
This is miraculous, like the miraculous nature of his ascension into heaven. So it's going to require the Spirit to give you the gift of faith in order to believe it. So Jesus was inviting them to make an act of faith
yeah.
in his teaching. And of course, they did not. They walk away. And guess what? Jesus lets them walk away rather than calling them back. It's unlikely that Jesus would let them walk away due to a misunderstanding, especially the fact that they were disciples. They weren't yeah. enemies.
No. Nope.
They were following Jesus, right? And secondly, that he's teaching them how to get to heaven. And so given the gravity of the teaching, it's unlikely that he would let them walk away due to a misunderstanding. And then, of course, he turns to the apostles and says, will you leave me too? And Peter responds, Lord, you have the words of eternal life, right?
Right, right.
So Peter exercises the faith that Jesus was inviting his disciples beyond the 12 to exercise in response to his teaching. They did not. Peter did on behalf of the 12. And so those are markers or clues to indicate to us that when Jesus says, eat his flesh and drink his blood, he's speaking literally here and speaking in a way that's different than the way he speaks in John 10:9, I am the door, John 15:5, I am the vine.
It's a lot of clues that build up over the course of the sixth chapter of John's gospel. I mean, just the fact that he keeps repeating it over and over again.
Yes.
He never moves off of it. He never says, well, here, let me give you a different metaphor. Maybe this one will be, it just keeps saying it over and over. And then, like you said, giving these other signs, like
right.
letting people walk away.
Yeah. And speaking of the context, you know, and all of the clues building up, I'm glad you brought that up, because some Protestants will actually appeal to the preceding context of these words of Jesus about eating his flesh and drinking his blood as evidence for a metaphorical interpretation of Jesus's words. Because, for example, in John 6, verse 35, Jesus says, he who comes to me will never hunger. He who believes in me will never thirst. Hunger and thirst imply eating and drinking. These are being used as metaphors for believing in Jesus.
Right.
And Jesus, yet again in verse 47, uses the same imagery concerning believing in him. And so some Protestants will argue that given that preceding context of eating and drinking associated with believing, we should transfer that metaphorical meaning over to eating his flesh and drinking his blood in verses 53 through 58, and therefore conclude that when Jesus speaks of eating his flesh and drinking his blood, what he intends is that we must believe in him. So he's intending these words to be taken metaphorical for belief in him. And that on the surface, it sounds very plausible, right? That sounds like a sound line of reasoning, right? But whenever we examine it, we're actually able to see markers of a shift. Because what's interesting is right around verse 49 or 50, the Jews quarrel when Jesus is talking about believing in him, but when he says, I have come down from heaven, they quarrel among themselves, right?
Right.
But in verse 51 through 52, and verse 53, depending on your translation and how the verses are parsed there, some are different. The Jews quarrel again, but it's about something distinct from Jesus coming down from heaven and about believing in him. They actually quarrel specifically about his claim to give us his flesh,
yeah.
which he says is the life, is for the life of the world, which is the bread from heaven. That's what they're quarreling about. And so that they are quarreling about the claim that the bread of life is his flesh indicates that there is a shift here, at least in the minds of the Jews, in the mind of the Jews, right?
Yes.
And so the question becomes, well, is there a shift as well in the thought of Jesus from metaphor and belief to actual eating his flesh and drinking his blood? And for all of the reasons that we've given already, indicate that there is indeed a shift, even in Jesus's mind, concerning metaphor and belief, like speaking metaphorically to convey the idea that we need to believe in him, to actually partaking of his flesh and his blood. And I would even add that drinking blood doesn't, that if we think of that as a metaphor, that doesn't map on with quenching thirst, right?
No.
As water would, which is implied in Jesus' statement of believing me, you shall never thirst, right? Your thirst will always be quenched in believing Jesus, because from him flows the life-giving water of the Spirit, as we read about, I think in, is it John? I think it's John, either John chapter 7, I think it is, where he talks about, you know, the life-giving water of the Spirit. And so that Jesus speaks of flesh, which he doesn't in the preceding context about believing in him, and that Jesus speaks of drinking his blood, which he doesn't talk about in the preceding context of believing in him, indicates further that there is a shift in Jesus's mind between using metaphors to convey the idea of believing in him and actually eating his flesh and drinking his blood.
Carla Broussard is our guest, the Bible Blueprint for the Eucharist and the Priesthood, this hour, 888-318-7884. If it bothers you what Carla just had to say, you're welcome to call. And if you'd just like further clarification, you're welcome to call, 888-318-7884.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Carla Broussard is our guest. We're talking about the priesthood and the Eucharist, and you can probably guess why, because tomorrow's Holy Thursday, and on Holy Thursday, the priesthood and the Eucharist play the central part in our liturgical celebrations and in our remembrance of Jesus. This whole week is about remembering the core of what Jesus did for us in dying and rising for us, and to liberate us and to show us that we are liberated from sin and death. That makes it a great week. That makes it the most important week of the year. But in particular, Holy Thursday focuses a great deal on the priesthood and the Eucharist. You're welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. I see the lines lighting up now, but first, Carlo and I were saying, where did everybody go? Because I thought everybody's getting on the road to go home for Easter break. And so the second hour, fewer calls, but a lot of lines have been open, so you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, and we're going to go to those lines in just a moment. Somebody mentioned Father John Trujillo earlier. I just wanted to wish happy birthday, because how do we know that this is his birthday? Like, somehow one of you realized it's Father John
Wait a second. Happy birthday, Darren.
I didn't know it was your birthday, Darren.
Wow.
I would not.
For the listeners who were listening, he just chimed in our ears here in the headphones and said, I know his birthday because I share a birthday.
And we didn't know that it was your birthday.
Man, we're not very good friends.
Now I just feel terrible. This is mortifying. This is a true mortification to find out that I missed Darren's birthday. All right, we're going to celebrate it next week. We'll get a cake for Darren next week, because all our fasting will be over. Again, our number, 888-318-7884. I don't even know what to do with that. I don't even know. Did you tell us in the last 15 minutes that it's your birthday? I feel terrible. All right, I'm going to go to the phones. This will make me feel better. I'll go to the phones. All right, Carlo?
All right, sure.
James in Texas listening on 98.3 FM. Thank you so much for your call. James, go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yes. It's kind of a, it's going to be kind of, a, if it's okay, kind of a back and forth.
Sure.
I'm going to present the questions. And for the first couple questions, it'll be a it's kind of a yes or no answer. So my first question is Catholic belief, Catholic tradition, Catholic religion, however you want to phrase that, says that to get to heaven, it's not through the cross only. It's through works and tradition as well as through Christ. Is that correct in a nutshell?
Well, it's kind of hard, James, to give a yes or no answer there because the question is a loaded question and certain qualifications have to be made. And so if I were to summarize my answer to that question, it is only through the cross that we can have even have possibly have the life that is necessary to exist in heaven. And so the question is, how is that life applied to us? As the Bible reveals, it's through faith in Christ, which is given to us in a perfect way initially in the sacrament of baptism, 1 Peter 3:21, that saves us, and that on condition that we remain in that loving relationship with Jesus, because remember, Romans 5:5, God pours forth, the love of God is poured forth in our heart. As long as that love of God remains in our heart until the moment of our death, we will enter into the beatific vision. Where do works come into play? Works come into play once we receive that love, and those works are a manifestation of that love, and actually a way by which we can preserve that love and increase in that love. The more you serve Christ, the greater love you have for Christ. And we, as lovers of Christ, want to increase in that love because the lover always wants to love the beloved more. And so that's in a summary, in a nutshell, of the Catholic view of salvation.
Okay. And so your view on purgatory. So those who, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't know the exact words. I am not... I probably haven't been in a Catholic church a dozen times in my life.
Okay.
So I do know that the Catholic religion, tradition, and I don't even know what word is the correct word to use in that aspect,
okay.
A belief, a doctrine, whatever we want to,
sure.
Whatever is the correct term, believes there is a purgatory. And for those who are... to simplify, do not qualify for heaven, but maybe were a good person or a decent human being, there is a purgatory where over a period of time, through prayers, through giving of your relatives or friends or whomever it may be, you can slowly or you can gain or work your way into heaven. Out of purgatory. Is that a correct or a...
All right. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, James.
So actually, that would be incorrect on two points. So, number one, you said purgatory is for like a good person who doesn't quite qualify for heaven. That would be incorrect because any soul in purgatory does qualify for heaven insofar as they're guaranteed heaven. They have Jesus's love in their heart. They have sanctifying grace. They're united to Christ. And so heaven is guaranteed for them. It's not a second chance. There's no possibility whatsoever of the souls in purgatory ending up in hell. Heaven is theirs. Now, it is true that they cannot immediately enter into heaven right away because of some whatever remaining remnants of sin, whether it's the guilt of sin, unhealthy attachments to created goods, and even what we would call in the Catholic tradition the debt or the liability of temporal punishment due for sin. That's a whole nother ball of wax there to deal with, another can of worms. But just the point being is that we want to make sure we're clear on the status of the souls in purgatory concerning their salvation. They are saved. Heaven is theirs. They just need to be finally purified to achieve that perfect holiness necessary to enter into heaven. Now, there was a second, the second point, which would be incorrect, James, in your articulation, is that the souls in purgatory work their way into the immediate entrance, into the entrance of the beatific vision or heaven. That is not the case. There is nothing that the souls in purgatory do on their own behalf that contributes to their purification coming to an end. They are entirely reliant upon God and in God's divine providence upon us who can assist them. Just like you can assist me, I can assist you in my growth in holiness, your growth in holiness, so too we can assist the souls in purgatory in their growth of holiness for their purification coming to an end. But they can't do anything for themselves in cooperating with God's grace whatsoever. That's not going to contribute in any way to their purification coming to an end. So those would be two points that I would want to clarify concerning your articulation of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory.
Got more back and forth, James? Did you have more?
Yeah, I had a couple more, and then I'll let you go. This could be something me and you could probably talk about for a week.
Sure.
All these things.
Yeah,
could,
that's right.
I don't want to intervene in anybody else who may be wanting to call in. So my whole area where I was going with this is when somebody asks me about salvation, to me, salvation, the best illustration of salvation did not partake in the Eucharist, did not do any works, did not.
Okay. So what's the illustration, James?
Confession.
Right.
It is the thief on the cross.
Okay. Yes. That's great. James, we got to answer that just because we only have about a minute left. But okay,
yeah,
so the thief on the cross
calling it like the last minute here.
But I love James's questions, yeah. And so the thief on the cross did nothing.
Yeah,
and you said we have to do.
Here's the simple answer: paragraph 1257 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, James, teaches that God has bound salvation to the sacraments, but God Himself is not bound by the sacraments. God can administer the grace of salvation in whatever way He chooses. But He has set up an ordinary way by which we receive the graces of salvation, and that's through the sacraments, the Eucharist included. But that does not mean that God cannot administer the grace of salvation apart from the sacraments, as He did on the cross when He was administering the grace of salvation to the good thief through His repentance, through His contrition, through His love for Christ, coming to the defense of the innocence of Christ, and, of course, the reward being Christ saying to him, "You will be with me this day in paradise." And we can assume that Jesus was guaranteeing that eventually the good thief would be with him in heaven, right? Abraham's bosom after death until Jesus ascends into heaven. So we can affirm both, James. We can affirm the good thief on the cross being saved without the sacraments. Amen. But that in no way undermines the Catholic belief that Jesus instituted the Eucharist and the other sacraments as means of salvation, because that's the ordinary ways for those to whom it is revealed and for those for whom they are able to participate in the sacraments. God's going to administer the graces of salvation to those. But if they're not able to participate in the sacraments, or they don't have that revelation and they're not responsible for their ignorance, well, then sure, God can administer the graces of salvation to those people as well.
James, I'm sorry that we're out of time. Maybe you'll call back and we'll talk again sometime.
Okay.
Yeah, we appreciate your good spirit, brother. God bless you.
In your church, you celebrate Easter this week? James?
We do.
Okay, then I'll say happy Easter to you, and God bless you. I hope we'll get to speak again.
Thank you.
Carlo, thank you very much. I really enjoy it. Well, you get like this great call and then a whole bunch of other calls right at the end. But
we'll just have to do it again.
I'm sorry to the callers that we didn't get to. I am very grateful to James for the call, and I'm very grateful to you, Carlo Broussard, for us taking 2 hours with us.
Well, thank you for being grateful, Si. I'm grateful to you.
All right.
I'm grateful for your gratitude.
And how grateful do you feel that Darren was born?
I am totally
grateful. Isn't that great good news?
Happy birthday to you.
I was trying to harmonize. Sorry. I did it.
Happy birthday.
Hey, we got a show tomorrow. We'll see you then. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.